Hey, it's Jen. Just a quick heads up before we start the show. The news is rapidly developing, and things may have changed by the time you hear this episode. For the very latest news, tune into your public radio station and follow updates at npr.org.
This is 1A. I'm Amna Nawaz of the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. It's time for the news roundup.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain.
Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick became the fifth private citizen in U.S. history to lie in honor at the Capitol Rotunda. Sicknick died from injuries sustained during the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building. More than 50 officers were injured in the attack, and in the week since, two have died by suicide. It's been almost exactly 1 month since the incident, and the fallout continues, both on Capitol Hill and across the country. We're going to get into that, but first, let's start with another crisis gripping America, COVID-19. Joining us today, Brittany Shepherd. She's the White House correspondent for Yahoo News. Brittany, thanks for being here. John Fassman's also with us. He's the Washington correspondent with The Economist. John, welcome to you. And Helen Branswell is a senior writer on infectious diseases for Stat News, a health and medical news outlet. Helen, welcome to 1A.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with some good news on the COVID front. The surging coronavirus numbers we've seen since the fall reversed this week. New daily cases are down 16%, hospitalizations are down 15%, and deaths are down 6%. But with Super Bowl Sunday around the corner, Dr. Anthony Fauci had a warning for the viewers of Good Morning America.
Every time we do have something like this, there always is a spike, be it a holiday, Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving. As much fun as it is to get together on a big Super Bowl party, now is not the time to do that. Watch the game and enjoy it, but do it with your family or with people that are in your household.
Why the warning? Well, it's a reminder that we're still in the thick of the pandemic. And even though numbers are trending downward, some, including new daily cases and deaths, are still higher in the U.S. than they were almost all of last year. Helen, I want to spend a little bit of time with you understanding what this week showed us about where we are in the pandemic. So let's start with those numbers. They do offer a little bit of hope. What's behind those declines in infections and hospitalizations and deaths?
Well, I'm not 100% sure. I think there isn't one single reason. There are probably a bunch of different things. Part of it is that we're getting out past the surge of cases that would have been triggered by Thanksgiving and then Christmas family gatherings. So now that we're past that, some of the numbers are going to start trending down. You know, there may be things related to a bit of saturation in some communities, although that isn't clear, and it's also probably not long-lasting. What is clear is that there's still a ton of virus out in the United States, and as you mentioned, more of it than at any point in previously, except for the peak, any point previously in this epidemic. So people really need to be careful when they're thinking about what they want to do and not assume that, you know, we're past the worst of it.
Well, that leads me to my next question. I remember coming into the winter, all the experts were saying we were entering the pandemic's darkest days. What I hear you saying now is we are still in those. The worst is not yet behind us. Is that right?
You know, we can't know, but much of what happens between now and the point at which a lot of the country gets vaccinated is in our control. The problem is we keep refusing to take it. You know, there are mitigation measures that clearly work, things like masking and distancing, and yet people resist them in some places. And, you know, as always happens when the numbers start to dip, the states start to loosen restrictions. You know, the gym up the street from me opened again this week. And I understand why people do that, but, you know, if we see a corresponding increase in cases a few weeks from now, we will know that it's because we're not taking enough, we're not being cautious enough. We keep doing that.
And Helen, of course, people are also hearing a lot more about these new, more contagious variants. What new information did we learn this week about those?
New information, you know, they're around. They continue to spread. They, and they seem to erode to some degree the efficacy of the vaccines. Fortunately, a number of the vaccines are very efficacious, so, you know, a little bit of erosion isn't going to be a huge problem, but that is a worrying thing. What else have we learned about them? They are, you know, we don't have a great sense in the United States how widely dispersed they are. We're not doing as much full genome sequencing in the United States as, for instance, the United Kingdom is. So, you know, we don't have an eye on the changing virus population, you know, across the country. So that's another reason why people really need to be careful at this point.
And another reason experts are saying, as you mentioned, those mitigation efforts need to continue. Well, the nationwide vaccine effort is now in its seventh week, with Alaska in the lead, where 13% of residents have received their first doses. But a report from the CDC revealed that we don't know the race or ethnicity of nearly half of the Americans who've been vaccinated so far. Brittany, let me ask you about this, because we have known throughout the pandemic, Black and Latino and Native communities have been the hardest hit. When I interviewed Dr. Rochelle Walensky recently, just as she took over the CDC, she said for this administration, equity would be key to their response. What do we know about how the federal government is building equity into their pandemic response?
Well, Anma, we know that the White House is incredibly frustrated with this lack of data. Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith, she's the chair of the White House COVID Health Equity Task Force, which just even having that task force is a step in the direction that the Biden administration feels that the Trump administration just simply didn't care about and simply didn't have. She said earlier this week that she's so worried about how behind the Biden administration is as far as data is concerned, and that I believe the exact quote was, she cannot ensure equitable vaccination program without the data to guide us. And if we think a little bit back to the transition, I know it seems years ago, there was so much gumming up with budgetary issues, with the Trump administration not being able to hand over confidential information, especially when it comes to vaccination, the CDC, to the Biden folks, that this became a domino effect and affected a lot of things, not just vaccine distribution, but just access to equitable data. So there's that issue, just being able to see the information so the White House feels that they can act. There's also a concurrent problem, is that there is a vaccine hesitancy in communities of color around the country. And there are so many reasons why. I probably don't have the time to get into all of that. But the White House believes that they can use someone like Vice President Kamala Harris, obviously a very prominent Black woman, to be able to speak to those communities. The thing is, with COVID, usually they would send someone like Harris out to places like West Virginia, Delaware, across the country, Atlanta, Georgia. But now they can't. And they're relying on folks tuning into virtual briefings, folks, you know, maybe the me's and you's the world turn into, but other folks have jobs and are worried about how to get food on their plates for their families. So there's a bit of an information gap they're struggling with. So the hope is to blanket the airwaves as much as they can. But of course, there's a natural limit to what they can do. That's why the White House is pressuring these budget committees on the Hill today and the rest of the week as they redraft this reconciliation package to pack as much money as they can for racial outreach, because they're very, very worried. It's not just having the vaccine be available, but getting the vaccine into people's arms. And just like Helen was saying, if folks aren't getting vaccinated, then we're going to continue to be in this grim place. And the Biden campaign feels like, sorry, Biden White House now, feels like they're up against a brick wall.
And I want to get into the details of that budget package in just a moment. But John, more broadly speaking, when you're looking at this equity conversation, where is that conversation on Capitol Hill? I mean, I remember a few lawmakers over the last few months have said they want to make it more of a focus. They want to push funding towards better tracking and outreach to those underserved communities where there is vaccine hesitancy. Is that something lawmakers are prioritizing right now?
I think it has to be, and I think they're in a good position. The Democratic control of both houses puts Congress in a good position to follow through on the Biden administration's equity priorities. And the reason why this is so important is that you see, it's not just the missing data in this report, it's the far higher rates of infection, hospitalization, and death in African-American, Latino, Native communities as well. And that just speaks to existing inequities in the health system that have grown over a period of years and decades. And I think the Biden administration's hope in pushing for equity, Democratic lawmakers' hope in pushing for equity, is that you really rethink how to get out of these systemic inequities and you craft policy in a way that ensures an equitable response and ensures that we don't fall into the same patterns that have existed for all these years.
It's the News Roundup. We'll be back with more from you and from our guests in a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
It's the News Roundup. Let's jump back into the conversation. Well, as of this week, nearly half of U.S. states have begun vaccinating teachers. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky said Wednesday that schools reopening should proceed regardless.
I want to be very clear about schools, which is, yes, ACIP has put teachers in the 1B category, the category of essential workers. I would also say that vaccination of teachers is not a prerequisite for safe reopening of schools.
So ACIP is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices at the CDC. Helen, on this question of school reopening, where do reopenings stand nationwide? I mean, teachers' unions, we know, have really been pushing back on returning to classrooms all until they're vaccinated, right?
Yes, I think so. But I mean, I think there's a mix of across the nation of, you know, places where there's some in-person schooling happening and also online. I mean, obviously, there is a big push to get teachers vaccinated, although not all states are doing it, as you mentioned. The recommendation to include teachers in 1B, which came from the ACIP, as Dr. Walensky mentioned, hasn't been adopted in all states. Some states are doing a different approach, focusing more on age-related vaccination than on frontline essential workers.
And Helen, what does the data show us so far about the roles that schools or classrooms have played in the spread of the virus?
You know, there's been a lot of attention paid, but also a lot of sort of fog around the role that kids play in transmitting the SARS-2 virus, the virus that causes COVID-19. But very recently, the CDC published some data that suggested that transmission in school isn't as big a deal as, you know, some might have feared. And in fact, that transmission in school seems to occur at a lower rate than in the communities around them. So that, I think, is what led Dr. Walensky to make her recommendation. Obviously, the CDC is advocating for schools to take, you know, all necessary precautions in terms of distancing, masking, you know, good hand hygiene, good hand hygiene procedures in the schools to clean up, to make sure that kids aren't getting infected from surfaces and stuff. But they feel that school can proceed safely.
Brittany, this idea of getting schools back open, that's at the heart of the pandemic response for the Biden administration as well. They want to get the economy back up. People have to get back to work. To do that, they need their kids back in school. It's something President Biden has explicitly said is a priority. But what is their plan to make that happen?
Biden's plan to make that happen is to have many K through 18 schools open in the first 100 days. But something really fascinating is going on with this teacher vaccination comment made by Dr. Walensky this week, with the White House trying to walk some tightrope between their negotiations with the teachers unions and trying to put pressure on lawmakers on the Hill to, you know, stuff this package through budget reconciliation. Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, kind of downplayed what Dr. Walensky said yesterday, saying that Dr. Walensky spoke in her personal capacity, whatever that means, as opposed to her capacity as CDC director, which doesn't really make sense because she was speaking at a health briefing at the White House to reporters. And Jeff Zients, he is the individual helping coordinate vaccination and COVID rollout for the White House, said that it's a priority for him, the team, and for Biden to reopen schools safely. But instead of them giving very specific answers to the teachers' unions, to us reporters, he says instead that's why it's important for members of the Senate and the House to push this bill through expediently. This is a $1.9 trillion, very expensive package, and a bulk of that package is money for PPEs for schools, for smaller class sizes, to get ventilation. Of course, opening schools would be insanely popular. President Biden has a very decent approval rating right now. Just think of what the ability to open schools could do for him now. So there's like a just, and his approval rating going forward. So there's a bit of like a political theater here. Just because Trump is gone and him fighting with Fauci isn't happening doesn't mean that there's not some grandstanding happening in the Brady briefing room. And I think it's a tightrope that the Biden team is going to have to walk for a long time, because parents want their kids to go to school. Students want to go to school. But teachers' unions say, you know, if teachers, we go to school, we might get infected and we might die. So there is not a lot of clarity coming out about how exactly the White House will implement this policy. But certainly there is a bit of dodging and putting pressure on members of the Hill instead.
Well, John, Brittany mentions that massive COVID relief bill that Biden has proposed, $1.9 trillion. It's working its way through Congress, really along party lines. There's a lot to be done before the legislation is passed. But the Senate did push ahead a budget plan that includes the Biden economic package. That whole session took 15 hours. John, walk us through what happened there.
Well, the administration wants, and congressional, the administration wants a, or at least says that it wants a bipartisan package. There is a group of Republicans who met with President Biden on Monday night and proposed a bill that was about one third the size of his. Now, I think that Biden's $1.9 trillion bill may have been a maximalist opening position. The Republican $600 billion bill may have been a minimalist one. So I think that negotiations are ongoing, and President Biden is serious and sincere when he says he prefers a bipartisan response. But there are a lot of people in the Biden White House that were there in the Obama administration, the first term of the Obama administration, and I think the lesson they learned from the Affordable Care Act was to be wary of extended negotiations. You remember back then, Republicans negotiated with them for, I think, 8 or 9 months, and then ended up not backing the bill. So I think what Democrats are doing in the Senate right now is putting themselves in a position to pass the bill through reconciliation, which is a parliamentary maneuver that allows the passage of bills related to federal spending and revenue with a simple majority, rather than having to break the filibuster, rather than requiring 50 votes. So they're sort of lining it up right now. And I still believe that if Biden can find a way to get through a bipartisan bill that is maybe $1.3 trillion, $1.4 trillion, he would be inclined to do that rather than pass a bill along straight party lines. But he's not going to negotiate forever. He's not going to let this gum up his infrastructure plans, which he wants to push through as well. And so I think that that what is happening in the Senate is that they're getting in position to push a bill through along party lines if necessary, even though that may not be what the administration really wants.
So, Brittany, it goes now to the House of Representatives. It's also expected to pass there, mostly along party lines. But as John just mentioned, Biden wants a bipartisan package. Democrats don't need Republicans, right? But is there a downside to going it alone right now?
Well, it's fascinating to think about the word bipartisanship. We've asked the White House what they mean by bipartisan, and then they keep citing polls that the American public, even Republicans from red districts, they overwhelmingly support the American Rescue Plan. So I think that in their mind, they might be able to forego working with Republicans, but still be able to claim that they are passing widespread popular agenda. I think the issue is banking that you have the entire Democratic Caucus caucus support. And I think it depends on what exactly is being needled through these House committees, these budgetary committees. So something like the $2,000 checks. Biden and the White House says that they don't want to compromise on that. But if you look at more centrist Democrats like Joe Manchin, they say he says like, oh, well, he doesn't support a $15 minimum wage or necessarily a very large scale relief check program that's not targeted. Right. So Democrats in the Biden White House can bank on reconciliation all they want. But if they can't get unilateral support from Democrats, then it doesn't really matter anyway. I think right now, you'd say what happened last night with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Liz Cheney, the Republican Party is so fractured among partisan lines and in a similar way the Democrats are too, that Biden trying to negotiate in good faith presents a lot of risks. You see Leader Schumer saying that they don't want to have 2009. Again, they don't want to risk going too small because people's lives are on the line. So I think that they care a little bit less about the optics of politics of shaking someone like Mitt Romney's hand and then just getting relief checks to the American people. Because at some point, that approval rating is going to go down and folks are going to be worried because more of their loved ones are getting sick, more of their loved ones are dying, and people are just going to get fed up.
We're going to get into more behind that GOP fissure in just a moment, too. But Helen, before we let you go, I should ask for folks who haven't been following along with all of the details. Brittany mentioned a few of the highlights that are included in this massive COVID relief bill, but give us just a brief overview. What folks should know is included in that package that President Biden is pushing right now?
Well, I'd actually have to defer to John and Brittany. They'd know more about the details, the non-sciencey COVID details than I would. I mean, in terms of, you know, the area that I work on, I mean, there's money, obviously, for the rollout and for the purchase of vaccines, both of which are crucial. The previous administration had not been convinced that jurisdictions needed money to deliver vaccine. Don't know why that didn't occur to them, but we're all paying for that now because the rollout has been going so poorly. So obviously getting money to the states and the local authorities to help them you know, roll out the vaccines, work up the computer systems needed to collect the kind of data that everybody wants to see. These are critical things and will be very useful going forward.
And Helen Branswell is senior writer on infectious diseases for Stat News, a health and medical news outlet. Helen, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Amna Nawaz. You're listening to 1A. While it's a tale of two Republican parties this week, the House voted Thursday to strip Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene from her recent committee assignments. That's after a slew of videos from her life pre-election showed her spreading conspiracy theories, holding bigoted views, and endorsing the execution of Democratic lawmakers. Brittany, this vote moved forward despite strong and widespread pushback from Republicans. But what does that tell us about where the GOP is right now?
I think it tells us a couple of things. 11 members of the Republican Party voted to remove Marjorie Taylor Greene from her House committeeships. 61 Republicans voted to remove Liz Cheney from Republican leadership. And it shows that even though Trump might not be on the throne, Trumpism is still a kingmaker in the party. And I haven't had the chance to speak to a lot of voters because I'm stuck here in DC because of COVID, but you have to wonder how continuously fractured Republicanism is, because if you speak to a centrist Republican, a random one you might find in the House, they might say, well, Republicanism is to me is reducing the deficit, having conservative ideologies and getting the government out of our business, yada, yada, yada. But it seems more and more these days that it's influenced by like reactionary internet politics of like, well, cancel culture is bad. And I'm a member of Congress, I'm going on national television to tell you that I am being silenced. You know, you really can't circle that square. It's a bit ridiculous. And it's puzzling to see how anything can become more moderate from here. And there are a lot of reasons why this happens. The proliferation of the internet forums, we can go on to that for hours, but you have to wonder how much of a vice grip Trump and those in his orbit, look like Sarah Sanders, she's running for governor of Arkansas, will continue to have on lawmakers from the outside. If Marjorie Taylor Greene is anything, to me, this is open anti-Semite, right? You know, if it's representative of anything, it's that folks like her might not be the outlier in the party, but maybe where the party is headed. And that can be a bit concerning, especially to voters and especially to Democrats here in D.C.
And concerning maybe even to some of the leadership in the Republican Party. It was interesting to see in the upper chamber, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell said Greene's, quote, loony lies and conspiracy theories are cancer for the Republican Party and for our country, end quote. John, those are very strong words from a man of few words. But what is he doing, if anything, to rid his party of that cancer, as he put it? What can he do?
I mean, I don't think he's doing much, and I don't think he can do much. And they are strong words, but they are really just words. I think if Marjorie Taylor Greene were to run for Senate in Georgia in 2022 and win, I don't think Senator McConnell would refuse to seat her. And so he is saying all the right things. And I really think that he does believe them. I mean, he is a longtime sort of establishment Republican who believes in small government, shrinking deficits, all the things that were standard orthodoxy among Republicans for years and years. But it's really hard to shake the feeling that he's fighting a rearguard battle right now, and that as embarrassing as establishment Republicans might find Congresswoman Greene, I mean, her voice and voices of people like her really do seem to be ascendant right now.
Well, Brittany, you mentioned that vote to strip Republican Liz Cheney of her leadership role within the party that failed this week. She's of course been under fire since voting to impeach President Trump last month. But Brittany, when you look at the contours of that vote and who supported what does that reveal to you about the Republican Party right now?
I think it reveals something like John was saying, that there are a couple senior Republicans, old school, old guard Republicans who are fighting a battle on many fronts. You see a couple of freshman members who are supporting Liz Cheney. I feel like the new guard of the Republican Party kind of hangs on the fringes both ways. You have the Rep Greens, but you also have the Rep Kinzingers who, you know, don't have a problem with being very vocal about impeaching former President Trump and calling out what they believe to be his ability to cite an insurrection. Frankly, though, it's similar to what we're seeing with Marjorie Taylor Greene, is that folks might be fearful of breaking line. And it begins to question what bipartisanship might mean in the Biden era. Like, we throw that word around a lot, and so does he, frankly. And you have to wonder, does bipartisanship mean working with the Cheneys of the world, of the Greens of the world, or is it both? We have to remember that Biden worked with segregationists for a very long time and defends his work with them, saying that it was vital to get policy done. And I'm oversimplifying, but it's important to remember the history. So that kind of bipartisanship might also have to happen now, ones that are cringy, that folks might be embarrassed about, like John was saying. And I just think that that vote kind of speaks to what might be happening in the future.
We have to take a quick break, but we'll continue the news roundup after this.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
If you're never quite sure how to answer the question,
where are you from?
NPR's Rough Translation might be the podcast for you.
Yes, finally, someone else.
Give us your accents and your origin stories, your cross-cultural misfits, yearning to just be, and listen to Rough Translation on NPR.
You're listening to the News Roundup. Now, let's get back to the conversation. Well, President Biden signed three executive orders on immigration this week. One creates a task force to reunite migrant families separated at the border. John, this was something that the previous government basically abdicated their responsibility in, any kind of reunification effort. What do we know about how this task force would work?
Well, I'm not sure we know much yet. We know that he wants to do it, and we know that there are still, I think, 500-some families, parents of children that they cannot find. So it's going to be, you know, it's going to require skills that a lot of people in the Biden administration have and that were pretty thin on the ground in the Trump administration, and that is familiarity with the federal bureaucracy and understanding of how the system works, how to find people who've been lost. And I think it's a difficult task ahead, but it's one that needs to be done.
And what about the other executive order, specifically on immigration? What will be their impact, if any, on the immigration system right now?
Well, I think the executive orders we've seen so far are just an opening gambit. They call for sort of rethinking the MPP, the Waiting Mexico policy. They call for ending family separation policy. But the big battle is going to be legislative. And there, I think you may well see an early victory for the Biden administration in that Lindsey Graham has talked about wanting to reinstate DACA, which would create a pathway to citizenship for undocumented people brought here as children. Beyond that, I think it's going to be a heavy lift. Comprehensive immigration reform is one of those things that, you know, Congress has talked about and wanted to do for as long as I've been covering politics, which is quite a while. But the goal has always eluded them. But the real battle for immigration policy is going to be in Congress. I mean, the thing to bear in mind is that Donald Trump's administration had such a relentless focus on immigration, on changing American immigration policy, that it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time to undo it.
Worth pointing out, I don't think we've seen comprehensive immigration reform in this country for over 30 years. Everyone seems
That's
to
right.
agree it's long overdue. But also in Washington, we are now just days away from the second impeachment trial of former President Trump. Brittany, on Thursday, the House impeachment managers asked former President Trump to testify in that trial. He declined. Can the managers compel him to testify?
It would be a tall order. I think that Donald Trump feels a lot more comfortable, I would say, tweeting, but now that's not super possible, but issuing paper statements that are like tweets from his resort in Florida, then coming up to D.C. But instead, he's tapped folks like David Schoen, who actually represented Roger Stone in Stone sentencing and appeal, and Bruce Castor, who was actually gummed up with Bill Cosby's arraignment, to lead the team. And they are going to push that this is a First Amendment right issue and that nothing Trump said on the mall on the 6th can prove that it was him who incited all of those people to go to Congress and that led in the death of many and the suicides of others. And that rampage, I think they're trying to absolve him of all responsibility there. I think it would be a cold day in hell if we saw Donald Trump come to Congress, but nothing in this world is impossible, I suppose.
Nothing in this world is impossible. That's right. Well, John, Brittany just mentioned David Schoen. Just to remind people, there's been some changes to that Trump defense team recently. Who left? Why did they leave? Who joined?
Butch Bowers was the lead lawyer. He's a lawyer from South Carolina who defended people caught in impeachment before. It's not clear why they left. I think the thinking is generally that Donald Trump wanted them to say that the election was stolen, and they did not want to say that because it's untrue. And so the lawyers that he got to replace them, one is Doug Schoen, who, as Brittany pointed out, defended Roger Stone. The other is Bruce Castor, who was a county prosecutor who declined to indict Bill Cosby years back. And I think, as Brittany pointed out, what you're going to see is them making a robust First Amendment argument. Now, I think that argument is largely nonsense. There are a lot of things that a president can say that would be First Amendment protected speech, but that would still be impeachable. That would still be an impeachable offense. You know, calling for, you know, the exile of everyone of a certain race or ethnicity from the United States, he has the right to say that under the First Amendment, but it would still be an impeachable offense. It would be an unworkable policy. I think the more difficult task that Democrats are going to have is the argument they'll present that Donald Trump did not incite this, that a lot of this was pre-planned. And I think the more we see from online chatter, the more evidence that there is that a lot of people were talking about storming the Capitol before Donald Trump gave the speech. So I think calibrating the exact responsibility of Donald Trump's words on what people did on the 6th is going to be that's where the main challenge for the House managers is going to lie.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those arguments we anticipate, because oral arguments before the Senate are expected to start next Tuesday. You mentioned David Schoen, one of the defense lawyers for Trump. Here is what he told Fox News this week.
Besides the fact that this process is completely unconstitutional and that this is a very, very dangerous road to take with respect to the First Amendment, putting at risk any passionate political speaker, which is really against everything we believe in this country, foundation of the First Amendment. But I'm going to tell you, I think it's also the most ill-advised legislative action that I've seen in my lifetime.
Brittany, from what we have seen so far, we know the legal team for Mr. Trump also filed a defense brief that gave us some details. What does it look like the heart of their defense strategy is going to be here?
Well, it seems like the heart's going to be twofold. One, just like John was saying, it was the robust First Amendment argument. There's something to be said, though, I do think it's quite feeble, that political language is always very packed. Like, politicians always speak in feast or famine or war mode to be able to speak to their base, get fundraising, and that what Trump said on the 6th was just an extension of that. And there will be kind of different versions of that same argument, I think, made throughout next week and into the month. And then the second is what Mr. Schoen actually told the New York Times, is that at least some, if not a majority of the Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol plan their attack in advance. And there is some data that both impeachment managers and Trump lawyers could use to support this by data with the pinging of the phones. And just to get into little tech ease, is to be able to see how many folks walked over from where Trump gave his speech to the Capitol. Democrats could try to use that data from cell towers to prove that there was a certain amount or significant and then or insignificant amount on the Republican side. A lot of that stuff is, you know, a bit nebulous, though. And it will be hard to see how any of that can hold water. Though granted, it doesn't really matter how good or bad of a constitutional argument is made over the end of the month. If Trump has, you know, a vice grip on the party, then all of this will be for nothing. And I do want to say it's really just very fascinating to me where the priorities in Florida are right now. Trump is battling the SAG-AFTRA Guild, you know, because they tried to kick him out. And now he's just using that time to insult them and maybe not be mounting an argument against his second impeachment. So just kind of fascinating to see where things are. I know we haven't had Trump on Twitter in a while, and it's good to check in there, too.
It is. It's good to check in every now and again. But, John, I have to ask you about this issue of unity, right? This is something that President Biden ran on, has been saying will be at the heart of everything moving forward. There's the argument being made by a number of Republicans that moving forward with this impeachment trial prevents them from having that goal of unity in any way. How have we seen President Biden weigh in on the impeachment trial, if at all?
Well, he has kept pretty quiet, which I think is the right thing to do. But I think there are a couple of important points to be made about unity. First, I just want to reiterate the great point that Brittany made about how it's kind of irrelevant what the arguments really are, because President Trump has a vice grip, as Brittany put it, on his party. And I think that finding 17 Republicans who will vote to convict him is really just vanishingly unlikely, whatever people say. So the Republican Party, in that sense, is demonstrating a tremendous amount of unity. The other thing about unity to remember, and I late last year I wrote a long piece about sort of looking at the history of Reconstruction. And if you go back to the 1870s, America prioritized unity over justice and accountability. And what happened was that you had basically an entire century of autocratic, racist, white rule in the South that condemned generations of African-American Southerners to second-class citizens. And I'm very leery of calls for unity without accountability. So I am all for unity. We can be unified against the idea that American democracy should be overthrown. We can be unified in support of the idea that we have a precious democracy that we need to protect. But unity does not mean just letting bygones be bygones at any cost.
Brittany, this issue of accountability, is that what we're hearing from a number of lawmakers in Washington, too, that there must be accountability before you can move forward?
Absolutely, especially from progressives on the way towards the White House, and who are worried that the Biden White House will forego any kind of holding folks' feet to the fire just so that there could be a kumbaya moment, just because he campaigned so heavily on that and he has such strong relationships personally with McConnell and with Republican lawmakers who we called colleagues for decades upon decades upon decades. You look like someone like Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, who says that she doesn't want to work with someone like Ted Cruz because someone like Ted Cruz, in her opinion, put her life on the line more than once, but especially on the 6th. Or for folks, she doesn't want to work with folks like Josh Hawley, basically everybody who voted to overturn the election or try to recertify the election in certain states. And I believe that that's pressure from progressives that's going to exist whether impeachment is here or not, that the centrist Democrats will be conciliatory to Republican centrists or otherwise. And I think that is going to be a big tentpole shift with the Democrats to see where they're going to go from here and if that pressure is going to be ratcheted up as the next 4 years drone on.
We're talking to White House correspondent Brittany Shepherd of Yahoo News and John Fassman with The Economist. The Proud Boys, an alt-right white supremacy group that helped to plan the insurrection, was formally labeled as a terrorist organization in Canada. Brittany, what does that designation mean?
Well, the intricacies are a bit above my pay grade, but it is basically saying that the Proud Boys, they're adamant Trump supporters, if they were ever to be present in Canada or come around the border, that they would be designated as domestic terrorists or terrorist entities, much like what we believe, like very large terrorist entities here in the United States. The Canadian Proud Boys are a little bit different than what's happened here in the United States, but it's really fascinating to see what a country like Canada would do before here, where the Proud Boys have been proliferating for the last 4 years online, I would say even longer. There is an issue with the Biden White House to try to figure out where they draw the line on who and what is a domestic terrorist. There's been some sheepishness, of course, in the last 4 years, but even beyond that, to designate certain groups, especially with those groups tend to be white, as folks who are trying to terrorize their own citizens. And what is happening in Canada might be a good tentpole for the Biden campaign. So I keep saying campaign. It feels like time is of the essence. It's the Biden White
House.
You're
not the only one these days, we have to say.
Oh, trust me. it's a good blueprint for what the Biden White House might follow through. But of course, 73 million people did vote for Trump, and they might see any designation of Trump supporters, no matter how violent or deadly they might be, as a condemnation of who they are as well, which I think just kind of speaks for itself.
Well, the designation in Canada, according to the AP, also means that Proud Boys members could have their assets seized. They can face harsher terrorism-related criminal penalties if they engage in violent acts. And also sending money to them or buying any of their paraphernalia could also be considered a crime. John, Brittany mentioned, of course, this administration, the previous administration in particular, struggled with what it means to be a domestic terrorist. What do we know about what this administration, the Biden administration, is doing about looking into this very real problem? I know Press Secretary Jen Psaki has been asked about this. What do we know?
Well, she's been asked about it, and she said that she's waiting for it for a review. So the Biden administration is thinking about, you know, they're conducting a review of domestic extremism right now. That's something that was very hard to do under the past couple of administrations. And I say past couple because even as early as 2009, you had a Department of Homeland Security review that said that President Obama's election has emboldened domestic terrorists, white supremacists. And that was suppressed by conservatives because they feared it would lead to suspicion of them. And I think that there's been an ongoing debate over what domestic terrorism is in the United States and what sort of legal tools we can use to fight it, because it does run up against some First Amendment problems in a way that the laws we have to combat foreign terrorism do not. I think we, if I remember right, we designated ISIS a terrorist organization, and therefore any support issued to them would render someone liable to prosecution under anti-terrorism laws. I think it's hard to find a coherent entity like ISIS that is a domestic terror group. I think that you often have lone wolf domestic terrorists, And you can't really sort of go after people for unpleasant political speech. So finding out exactly where to calibrate the laws so that they give prosecutors the tools they need to impede white supremacist terrorism in the United States without implicating or overstepping the bounds of the First Amendment is really, really tricky. And that's where the administration's task is going to lie in the coming months.
John, there's a political problem here as well, right? There were Proud Boys members who were out there on the day of the insurrection. I remember being out there reporting and seeing them. What's the political problem here with addressing this?
Well, the political problem is that you need sort of, I suppose you need buy-in from both sides. And again, you run up against the risk of criminalizing speech, which is something that nobody wants to do.
That is John Fassman with The Economist. Also with us today, Brittany Shepherd, who's the White House correspondent for Yahoo News. Thanks to both of you for joining us. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett, Mike Kidd, and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international segment of our news roundup after this. This is 1A. Back to our conversation in a moment, but first, a heads up that we'd love your help for an upcoming show about audio and true crime. True crime and mysteries are consistently at the top of the podcast charts, not to mention bestseller lists. What's behind our obsession with listening to murders and mysteries? And if you're a fan of the true crime genre, what draws you to it? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. We'd love to know more about your favorite true crime podcast and what elevates a mystery from good to great. Tell us, 855-236-1A1A. You can also send us an audio file with our app, 1A Vox Pop, and we'll share some of your stories soon.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is the News Roundup. After a coup on Monday, teachers and doctors are now part of growing protests against the military in Myanmar. They aren't the only country facing unrest. Thousands have been arrested during anti-Putin protests in Russia, diplomats are now being expelled, and India's government tried to squash demonstrations there with a massive internet blackout. How will the U.S. handle all this? We'll see if Joe Biden gave us any hints during his first public remarks on foreign policy since becoming president. Joining us this week are Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Joyce Karam is also with us. She's Washington correspondent for The National. Joyce, happy Friday. Welcome back.
To you too, Amna.
And we are thrilled to welcome back Indira Lakshmanan. She is senior executive editor at National Geographic. Indira, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Amna.
President Biden announced plans to halt U.S. support for a Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen.
This war has to end. And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales.
Now, that move fulfills a promise that Biden made on the campaign trail. Nancy, for those who haven't been following along on the details, what has been the impact of that Saudi-backed offensive in Yemen? What are they doing, and why was the U.S. supporting them?
So the Saudi-led coalition was fighting a war against the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen. It has led to a catastrophic human disaster there, 250,000 people killed, mostly by starvation, and no real progress in the status of the governance in that country. And so many blame the United States for the exacerbation of the human rights catastrophe there. And again, it became a proxy war for regional control. And so I think there was a feeling that the United States effort hadn't led to any enduring gains for any side, but rather protracted this conflict in which millions of civilians found themselves in the middle.
And Nancy, when you say many blame the U.S., what do we mean when we talk about support? Weapons, money, what?
So it started as intel sharing, helping coordinate strike campaigns. And the problem was that many saw those strikes rather than killing Houthi-backed rebels, military leaders, killing civilians. And then remember, this started back in the Obama administration. And then the United States pushed back a little bit. And by 2018, it halted its aerial support for those strikes and has really retracted since then. But in the early phases of the war, rather than sort of gearing Saudi Arabia, some saw it as enabling a military campaign that was doing more harm to civilians than to adversaries.
Well, Joyce, Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, says the U.S. plans to, quote, play a more active and engaged role in diplomacy efforts to end that conflict. What role is the U.S. currently playing on that front? What would change?
Yes, Emma, for sure. I mean, what we saw yesterday from the administration, the halting of the offensive support, we still don't know actually what they mean by that. For example, the Saudis consider all their war efforts as defensive. So does that mean arms sales? Does that mean drone supplies or intel sharing? We don't know yet. To what Sullivan said yesterday, I think what came out from the administration, the appointment of Tim Lenderking as envoy to the war in Yemen is significant by the Biden team. This is the first American envoy that will be addressing the conflict. For those who know him, he has worked on the Middle East at the State Department since 1993. So he's definitely a senior figure in that role. But at the same time, you know, saying we're halting support, we want to resolve the conflict is easier said than done. I mean, as Nancy mentioned, it's a big humanitarian catastrophe. You have, for example, Save the Children estimates that 85,000 Yemeni children under the age of five have died since 2015 in Yemen. So the American policymakers have to address the humanitarian problem ongoing in Yemen. But they also have to bring all the Yemeni stakeholders to the table. Those have different interests between the northerners and the southerners, and at the same time work with the tribes and with the outside stakeholders, including Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Hopefully, we are at the beginning of a complicated diplomatic process to get to a settlement for the four-year war over there.
Well, Indira, Nancy mentioned the Houthis. The Trump administration, we should remind people, had labeled Houthi rebels a terror organization. The Biden administration says it wants to review that decision. Just to remind folks, who are the Houthis? What should we know about them?
Right. The Houthis are a tribe in Yemen who have gotten support in this war from Iran. And that is really the reason why, you know, the sort of irony here beneath all of this is that it was under the Biden administration and Tony Blinken, now Secretary of State, but, you know, President Biden's longtime foreign policy advisor. It was during the Obama administration that Iran-allied Houthi forces took over Yemen's capital in the fall of 2014. And it was at that time that the Obama administration, perhaps somewhat reluctantly, but they did go along with supporting the Saudis with all the kinds of weaponry, logistical, and intelligence support that Nancy outlined. And so, you know, the Saudis, as well as the Gulf allies, including the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, began all these airstrikes, bought all these billions of dollars of American weaponry, and the idea was to oust the Houthi rebels from northern Yemen. Part of the issue here is that I think the Obama administration went along with supporting, you know, Saudi Arabia and UAE on this because Iran, you know, the Iran nuclear deal was ongoing in 2015 when the U.S., Russia, China, and the European Union allies got together and signed this Iran nuclear deal, Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest rival to Iran in the region, was really concerned and upset and worried about, you know, some sort of warming relations or that the U.S. was not taking the Iranian threat seriously. And so supporting Saudi Arabia and UAE against these Iran-backed rebels was part of the calculation at that time. But from 2014 to today, this has obviously changed. We're talking about more than 200,000 people dead in Yemen. The notion that the United States was somehow helping stop a humanitarian crisis has been undone. And while President Biden said in his speech at the State Department yesterday that he would continue other kinds of defensive support for the Saudis, he wasn't cutting off all arms sales to Saudi Arabia. You know, stepping back from that Yemen war, recognizing it for the catastrophe, the absolute human catastrophe that it has been with starvation and the death of so many women and children and non-combatants, you know, this is an important first step in cutting off offensive weaponry.
And Indira, what about that terror group designation? What does that mean, and why reverse it? What does that change?
Well, I mean, they haven't reversed it yet. I don't know. You know, we'll have to. This is giving them the opening to review it and reverse it. You know, I guess it's a way to justify, you know, why we would no longer be actively supporting Saudi Arabia's war against them. But I think, again, put this in the larger context of what's happening in the region, the fact that the Biden administration wants to revive the Iran nuclear deal, that's got to be part of the calculation. And I also think, you know, we just want to think about the larger context of this first foreign policy speech of the new Biden administration. Let's think about the other signals. He gave it at the State Department, not at the CIA or the Defense Department, which, you know, was what Trump liked to show, the images of hard power of the U.S. Here is Biden emphasizing diplomacy is back, America is back. He said that, you know, negotiations will be back at the center of our foreign policy. You know, he did not give any indication of whether he's going to hold Saudi Arabia and specifically the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman accountable for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist who was killed in a Saudi consulate in Turkey. But, you know, he gave a lot of other signals about U.S. foreign policy, fighting against authoritarianism, calling against the coup in Myanmar, warning Russia, saying that the U.S. will support LGBTQI rights around the world. And most importantly of all, I think, and this has gotten lost in the coverage because there's been so much focus on Saudi and Yemen, but also more than 10 times increasing the cap on refugees this year. The Trump administration had set it at 15,000 coming to the U.S. He's raising it to 125,000. So, you know, a huge increase there.
In Myanmar, police have now filed several charges against the country's elected civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. This follows the military coup on Monday. The exact whereabouts of the Nobel Peace Prize winner remain unclear. She has not been seen, nor has the country's president, since the military seized power. Indira, there has long been tension between the military and the government. Talk to me about the timing. Why did the army choose this moment to do this?
Yeah, well, as the listeners to this show are aware, in November, just a couple of months ago, Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy, NLD, the main opposition party, won more than 77% of the seats in parliament in what international observers were calling the country's first free and fair election. First in 2010, there was the first free and fair election in 25 years. Now, 10 years later, they won an even bigger amount of support, which was therefore giving Aung San Suu Kyi, in a way, backing and a mandate for the kinds of reforms and lessening of the military's role that she has been pushing for. Because remember, in these last 10 years, Suu Kyi has you know, sort of been running the country, but not really. She's been a state counselor alongside the Myanmar military, which has maintained significant power. In some ways, you know, she has really tainted her reputation in the eyes of the world. As you mentioned, she was a Nobel Peace Prize winner for her very brave and determined willingness to be in her home country when she could have been sitting pretty and safely in Britain. She had a British husband and kids, but instead she came back to her home country and endured many, many years of house arrest in her fight for democracy. But in the last few years, she's tainted that reputation by supporting the Myanmar military, not only at home, but in international courts in what most of the world considers to be a genocide of the Muslim Rohingya minority people in Myanmar. And she went along with it and basically endorsed it and said it was not a genocide campaign. But I think the spark for this at this point was that the military didn't want her to have this mandate to roll back their power, limit it, and move more in the direction of a parliamentary democracy. And they've arrested her. They've charged her with some pretty thin charges about, you know, importing some walkie-talkies. And they have absolutely no proof that the November elections were falsified and fraudulent, which is what they've been claiming.
And U.S. officials have now weighed in. President Biden made his first public remarks on the military takeover, and he called out those in power. Just a note, U.S. official policy is to use the country's former name of Burma. They say that they use Myanmar as a courtesy in certain communications. But here's what President Biden said.
The Burmese military should relinquish power they have seized, release the advocates and activists and officials they have detained, lift the restrictions on telecommunications, and refrain from violence.
Nancy, President Biden also threatened new sanctions. We know the United Nations has also condemned the coup. What's the latest that we know about what exactly is unfolding on the ground in Myanmar and what happens next?
So let's start with on the ground. We've seen that the government has blocked Facebook after residents there started posting photos of people banging pots and pans in support of Aung San Suu Kyi, of people holding up three fingers, a Hunger Games reference signaling resistance. And it's a big deal there because Facebook is used by half the population. It's the most dominant social media platform. And of course, it signals an effort to suppress any protests. This is relatively on the streets of Myanmar. We haven't seen protests, I think, the way that some would expect, out of fear. And this was sort of the first step towards speaking out. And the military-controlled government shut that down immediately. You mentioned sanctions earlier and the world response. What's been interesting is we've seen sort of two tranches of responses, if you will. From the U.S. and the EU and France, we've seen a demand that that the Aung San Suu Kyi and her colleagues be released. But we've seen from other countries in the region in particular stop short of that and say that they want the sustainment of sort of a democratic system in Myanmar. The most, I think, important response comes from Japan because they have close ties with Myanmar. And in the last few years, Japanese businesses have expanded their investment there. We saw protests in Tokyo in response to what happened there, calling for their government to do more. But from the government's perspective, they see sanctions as something that could push Myanmar closer to China. And what was interesting is the top government spokesman there sidestepped that question about whether the Japanese government would support sanctions. And so I think Japan will be the leader in terms of setting the world reactions response in Myanmar, and specifically whether sanctions are effective and an effective response or not. I'd remind listeners that past sanctions were against the very military commanders who launched this coup. So that certainly, as a data point, an indicator of how effective they could be.
Well, meanwhile, a crackdown in Russia has also caught the world's attention. Street protests last weekend led to more than 5,000 people being arrested. On Tuesday, another 1,400 people were detained for supporting jailed opposition leader Alexei Navalny. America's new Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, was asked earlier this week to respond to allegations made by the Kremlin of quote-unquote gross interference by the United States. Here's what he told NBC's Andrea Mitchell.
The Russian government makes a big mistake if it believes that this is about us. It's not. It's about them. It's about the government. It's about the frustration that the Russian people have with corruption, with kleptocracy.
Should the U.S. sanction the backers of Vladimir Putin as punishment for what has already happened to Navalny?
Actually, we're reviewing a series of Russian actions that are deeply, deeply disturbing.
Nancy, we know President Biden had his first phone call with Putin last week. We know he's taken a tougher stance. You hear Blinken saying they're reviewing all of these actions. How much pressure can the U.S. exert right now?
Well, that's an interesting question because technically we could see more sanctions on Russia in response to this. But the balance, I think, is on one hand, supporting democratic exercises of speech and other processes happening in Russia. At the same time, you'll hear Russians exploit that and say and call Navalny a Russian agent in their push to signal to their population that, that Navalny does not speak for the Russian people. And so I think that's the sort of fine line that the U.S. will find itself trying to walk. I think in the more immediate period, we could see more sanctions. But again, are those effective in stopping what Russia sees as one of the biggest threats to Putin's tenure?
Well, another piece of news from Russia that gave some reason to pause. Last year, Russia was the first to claim it had come up with a COVID-19 vaccine. This week, results published by The Lancet in the UK said that the Sputnik V vaccine gives around 92% protection against COVID-19. Now, we've pulled this clip from August of last year. That just gives you an idea of how quickly Russia moved on developing a vaccine. CNN spoke then to Kirill Dmitriev. He was chief executive officer of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, which backed Sputnik V's development.
I've given it to two of my 74-year-old parents. So time will tell. If it doesn't work, it'll be a major embarrassment to our health ministry. Lots of people, jobs will be on the line. And you have to understand, how do you get a bureaucrat in the health ministry to approve something like this unless the science is really solid, unless the track record of our platform is very solid?
Joyce, you heard him say, time will tell. There seems to be little doubt now that Russia did do something right and did do it faster than anyone else. A number of experts did cast doubt on their claims early on. Were they wrong?
I mean, Russia definitely took a risk in releasing the vaccine before the phase trial number three was completed. But the news we saw in the Lancet article, I think it's good news for global immunity. We already have 15 countries that are using the Sputnik vaccine for emergency purposes. But as you said, Amna, there are still unanswered questions from scientists and experts. Basically, that the trial design did not follow international standards for safety and efficacy, and that that was an issue all along. The second issue was the lack of transparency, and that the positive findings were presented without the level of detail needed and appropriate peer review that we saw with other vaccines approved by the FDA, for example. The authors of the Lancet article, actually, they do say that the trial in Moscow lacked ethnic diversity to make sure that the vaccine is safe on non-white groups. So what we saw with the 91.6% is good news, but we don't have enough data at this point. And the U.S. and Britain are saying today that they're not in a hurry to approve the Sputnik vaccine.
Well, Joyce, given some of those concerns around Russia's processes, are there other concerns about some of the other countries you mentioned who are using it for emergency purposes now?
We haven't seen many red flags, for example, from the UAE or Argentina that are using this vaccine, but it's still you know, when it comes to the U.S., when it comes to Europe, only a handful of countries have approved it. So I think the jury is still out, but they have good reference now with the Lancet, you know, approving them and commending their efforts.
The United States and Russia agreed to extend a crucial nuclear arms control treaty until 2026. That agreement was due to expire today. Indira, that treaty is called the START Treaty. Tell us what we need to know about it and what you took away from that announcement.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really some of the biggest news this week. I did want to just add one thing to the good information that Joyce was giving us about the Russian Sputnik V vaccine, which is, from a scientific point of view, one thing that's really interesting about that vaccine is that it is a different process. It's a regimen that uses two different harmless cold viruses called adenoviruses, as opposed to the mRNA technology being used by Moderna, Pfizer, BioNTech, which are approved here in the U.S. And so it's really interesting if that turns out to be a good and valid vaccine, which the Lancet report seems to show. We've written a lot about this at National Geographic about the science behind it. And obviously, the whole world wants to broaden the number of vaccines that are available, particularly in poor countries. And the Russian vaccine is one that was being used in a low-income country in Guinea and West Africa. On the START treaty, this is really interesting because the Trump administration, somewhat controversially, in the last months of its administration, was basically trying to use its leverage on the renewal of the U.S.-Russia New START Accord, which verifies limits on Russian and American intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and heavy bombers. And essentially, the Trump administration was trying to say, we're not going to renew this deal unless you bring in all of your nuclear posture into this. And they wanted to make it a three-way treaty with China's nuclear arsenal included in it too, which, by the way, is not a bad idea, because right now the world knows about Russia and the United States checking each other, but, you know, there are no checks on China in that respect. But you know, Joe Biden had campaigned saying he was going to renew it without conditions, and he did renew it for 5 years until 2026. So in the good news side of the ledger, it does keep in place this mutual verification regime. In the could be better side of the ledger, it certainly would be better to have you know, more visibility into other forms of you know, nuclear weapons from Russia. But I think this was seen as an important thing because there's so much tension in the U.S.-Russian relationship over cyber, Navalny, so many other things. And the Trump administration had already pulled out of two other treaties that were designed to reduce the chances of accidental war.
Nancy, let me ask you about Indira's mentioning there of the U.S. trying to bring China into this. The man who represents the U.S. on the U.N.'s disarmament conference is Ambassador Robert Wood. On Thursday, he called for a new arms control drive, saying, quote, the United States will also seek to engage China on nuclear arms control and risk reduction, as Indira just mentioned. Nancy, when it comes to nuclear weapons, is there any sign that China might be ready to come in from the cold?
Well, I mean, the conversation started between the United States and China under the Trump administration, and it really stalled. There was no indication that China was ready to jump on immediately. I think while Ambassador Wood's comments are illuminating, I think that the devil becomes in the details in terms of who's going to lead those negotiations, how aggressively will they go after them. I think this will be a long-term effort rather than one that can be turned around immediately. I think on one hand, China wants to be seen and respected as an international player in treaties like this, but I think the indication so far is that it will play tough in terms of the specifics of the deal itself.
This week, we're also remembering Scottish experimental pop musician and producer Sophie, who died in an accidental fall last weekend. The Grammy-nominated artist had a number of solo hits on the European club circuit, but also collaborated with dozens of musicians, including Vince Staples, Charlie XCX, and Madonna. Let's talk now about the farmers' protests still unfolding in India. Now, the Indian government imposed an internet blackout in and around New Delhi after protesters clashed with police last week. The restrictions were first imposed last Tuesday, but were then reinstated through at least Monday. Nancy, the protests, for anyone following along, did turn violent last week. Has that violence shifted the tone of the demonstrations?
I think it was a shock to everyone involved. I think there was an expectation that these would be peaceful. Remember, these are protests that began in November and had been relatively peaceful. But as they moved towards the capital and out of the provinces, we started to see a much more aggressive movement into the city, tractors coming in on a day that was supposed to be a national celebration. And so we have seen a sort of surprise that it took that turn and fears that it could go that way in the future. And I think it's because of that that for some in the Indian government, it is a justification for closing the internet. In fact, they've described this as a security issue in light of that violence. I think the challenge is that this is not the first time the Indian government has done this. It's a practice that they've used increasingly since 2015. And I think it's part of this larger playbook of clamping down on dissent in the world's biggest democracy. And so how one reconciles that, I think, is quite difficult. And again, it doesn't deal with the underlying issue that the farmers in India want a complete reversal of Modi's proposed changes to the economic infrastructure around farming. And so the underlying issues aren't addressed, and instead we're seeing a real lockdown on basic freedoms.
Joyce, Nancy mentioned briefly there what's at the heart of the protests. They have been going on since November. Let's just remind people a little bit, what's at the heart of those protests? What are those laws that they're there to protest?
I mean, the protests, yes, have been ongoing since November, but as also Nancy mentioned, only recently they're turning a little bit more violent. These farmers, you know, some of them driving tractors, took to the streets to repeal some of the contentious new agriculture laws that would cut their incomes. But the overall picture, I mean, this definitely fits a pattern in Modi's government in going after free speech. So they're becoming more about a crackdown. You've seen, Amna, 9 journalists have been charged just in the last few weeks for covering those protests. India, as Nancy mentioned, has the most mobile internet users, but at the same time has now the most suspension of the internet. So when we look at Modi's policies, we are starting to see a pattern. You know, Kashmir before that, they're curtailing free speech, and this could send India down a dangerous path of suppression of freedom of speech and intolerance.
Indira, we've seen not just those protests outside of New Delhi. There have been protests in solidarity across the country, even across the world. We're talking about a country where the majority of people still depend primarily on agriculture for their livelihood. What is at stake for those who've been taking to the streets?
Well, you're absolutely right that 60% of the population of India still depends on an agricultural livelihood. And at the heart of the issue here is that Prime Minister Modi has tried to ally himself with notions of greater economic growth, privatization, limits on government protectionism and aid for farmers. And all of this, you know, he claims that he's going to double the economy by 2024 and that a large role for government is no longer sustainable. But India's farmers are saying that they're struggling even with the few protections that they have, and that having more market-friendly laws and eliminating that regulatory support will, weaken the economy and starve the people. So it's a really big issue. It's not exactly clear, since this has become a big national issue, issue. By the way, you know, the shutting down of the internet that the Indian government has been doing is really troubling, because India, as we know, is the world's largest democracy, and yet Access Now, which is an internet freedom advocacy group, said that in 2019, India topped the world in terms of the number of internet shutdowns. So definitely efforts to limit free speech and keep a lid on these protests.
Indira, what does that internet blackout indicate, though? As Joyce mentioned, I believe they've used it before as a tactic. Does it signal a tougher crackdown could be coming from the government?
It certainly is a hint of that. You know, when India has used this in the past was they shut down the internet, for example, in Kashmir, the disputed region in the Indian part of the region in 2019. India rewrote the constitution to remove Kashmir's promised and protected autonomy. They shut down the internet there. They also shut down the internet in New Delhi that same year over protests over the citizenship law that was considered discriminatory against Muslims. So they've used these kinds of internet blackouts in an effort to prevent people from organizing and organizing protests and getting the word out. They've seen, it's obvious how internet access has helped people organize protests all over the world, including in Russia, the protests for Navalny that brought thousands of people to the streets all over the country in the last 2 weeks, we talked about earlier in the hour. India is aware, and if there are more internet blackouts, it's certainly going to be a stain on the country's reputation as, you know, the world's biggest democracy.
Nancy, what about some of the response we've seen online globally? We've seen the hashtag for farmers' protests growing. I never thought I'd get to say her name on this show, but Rihanna, the singer, has weighed in and also got a huge reaction from the Indian government saying she shouldn't be weighing in. Is any of that pressure, either online from around the world or from international leaders, is that going to change or influence the Modi government's response?
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned Rihanna, because what she asked was, why aren't we talking about this in reference to what was happening in India? And that led to a huge backlash from government, from some Bollywood actors about outside interference in Indian affairs. And what I find is the connective thread between that and what and Navalny and Indira mentioned it earlier, is that governments are citing opposition as a Western plot or being organized by a West, something that's not organic to the people. And so what Rihanna's tweet was, I think, a springboard to sort of make that argument again, that we can't have outside interference in our own governance. And we saw this again in Russia vis-a-vis Navalny in the past. The Russian government would make reference to him being an outside agent, and is now saying it overtly and repeatedly that these are not movements born within the country. And so what we saw from that tweet was just an indicator of the use of that charge as a tool to try to suppress opposition.
Indira, how does this play out? A lot of people have said this is a huge test for the Modi government. Will other international leaders weigh in? What do you see happening in the weeks ahead?
It's hard to predict. I mean, there are so many other problems for world leaders to weigh in on, whether it's the coup in Burma/Myanmar, whether it's the protests in Russia and the jailing, the imprisonment of Navalny on trumped up charges of not checking in for parole when he was actually in a coma and under medical treatment for having his underpants poisoned with a nerve agent. There are so many other things for the world to be protesting. We've talked a lot in this hour about the war in Yemen and the efforts by the Biden administration to try to jumpstart some peace talks there. I'm not sure that the Indian farmers, as big as an issue as it is for a country of 1.3 billion people, I'm not sure whether it's going to raise to the level of international pressure when there are other issues where thousands and thousands of people are dying, not to mention the coronavirus pandemic and other crises that the world leaders are having to take care of.
Plenty of crises around the globe, unfortunately. Another topic I'd love to get your take on. There are new accounts obtained by the BBC revealing that women in China's Uyghur Muslim internment camps have been systematically raped, abused, and tortured. Joyce, the accounts are incredibly horrific. What did we learn from these reports?
No, absolutely, Amna. It was actually very hard to read the BBC accounts. It's some of the most disturbing that we've heard of the violence in the Uyghur prison camps. I mean, we knew about surveillance, but the report, the BBC report mentions systemic rape, sterilization, sexual abuse, and torture. What this confirms is, if it's true, of course, is the reality of state police practices at the so-called re-educational camps for the Uyghurs. And instead of seeing action, constructive action or response from China, we're seeing now the debate descending into a media war between Britain and China. Beijing is calling the BBC report fake news. They're threatening to take action against the BBC and China's CGTN network had its license revoked in Britain. So it remains to be seen whether we see global action in that regard on what's going on in these camps. Will we see a boycott of the Olympics in 2022 in Beijing? We don't know yet, but yeah, the details from the BBC report are just horrific.
Indira, as we're talking about these horrific accounts from the BBC about Uyghur Muslim population in China's internment camps, they are horrific. We should remind people, too, the Trump administration in its final days did call this genocide, China's actions and repressions of Uyghurs there. That followed a Biden campaign statement with the same declaration. What is the U.S. policy and what is the U.S. and Biden administration been doing in the way to end this repression in China?
It's a really important step. Mike Pompeo took it literally on his last day in office, January 19th. He declared it a genocide. I suppose one could say, it was a parting shot, but it was one that, as you say, Joe Biden had said the same words on the campaign trail. It's really interesting because these latest allegations are absolutely horrific and they mirror things that we saw, rape as a tool of war during the Bosnia War, in Rwanda, in ethnic conflicts, ethnic cleansing conflicts around the world. We've seen this used repeatedly. But this is not news that China has had a million Uyghurs who are this Muslim, Turkic ethnic minority who live in Xinjiang province in western China, for years in these camps. And it's also not news that the policy goes straight to the top, that Xi Jinping himself, endorsed the policy of these re-education camps, as they call them. What's interesting is what sort of a burden it puts on the United States now that we've officially declared it a genocide. And normally, that kind of a designation could bring not only sanctions, but action, against China by the United States, but also potentially by the UN. The move to call it a genocide was praised by human rights groups. I just want to note that also in his last week in office was when Mike Pompeo declared the Houthis a terrorist group, which, as you pointed out, the Biden administration is looking at reversing or reconsidering, mainly because they want to get the Houthis to the peace talks, to the peace table. This point with the Uyghurs, it's really hard to see what kind of leverage the U.S. has. China is a massive economic power. We have all sorts of other fears about China with cyber and other kinds of threats that they pose. At the same time, the United States needs China for so many international policies, including, I might say, reviving the Iran deal that I talked about earlier. So, I will be watching with bated breath, certainly, to see what the Biden administration does to put the pressure on China over these camps and this now declared genocide.
Nancy, what about other world powers outside of the U.S.? Have we heard any responses or reactions from world leaders to this latest news? And can we expect any action or consequences from them?
I mean, it's worth noting that there have been up towards 3 million Uyghur Muslims who have been snatched from their homes in Xinjiang since 2017. And so I think it's fair to say that there's been an international failure to address this in any effective way. And I think we saw that in response to this peace, while there was condemnation, we haven't seen any tangible action that would stop something that by multiple counts now, over a period of years, has gone on and relatively unanswered by the world community.
Certainly something we'll be following in the weeks ahead. I want to thank all of you for joining us this week. Thank you to our wonderful guests. That was Nancy Youssef from The Wall Street Journal, Joyce Karam, Washington correspondent for The National, and Indira Lakshmanan, senior executive editor at National Geographic. 1A's managing producer is Paige Osborne. Jake Cherry is our sound designer and engineer, and Barb Anguiano produces the podcast. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Amna Nawaz from the PBS NewsHour, in for Jen White. To all of you out there, have a great weekend. Thank you for listening, and please stay safe. This is 1A.